And greetings, everyone. Welcome to Maine Arts Alive. As you all know by now through the year, this is WERU's tribute to the arts and artists who make up Maine. The interesting thing about this state, to my mind, is that just about everywhere you go, you find some of the most superb arts going on. And this is our salute to that. One of the many forms of arts that we have discussed over the year or so that this show has been on, we've not touched on authorship, writing. So I figured, all right, let's talk to an author. But one of the most fascinating aspects of writing has occurred just recently with the Ellsworth American. They have started a serialized mystery. Now, those of you that know the Ellsworth American have seen these sections in the newspaper. And probably, I hope, most of you have turned to them and gotten excited by the idea that each issue has a new chapter. Actually, serialized fiction, similar to this, which is titled, I got to make sure I get the right title, Murder at the Black House. And I guess I should say Murder at the Black House. Serialized fiction is not a rarity. It has been around. Perhaps not as much today as in the past, but it's been with us. Just think of Charles Dickens and how his stories were serialized in the newspapers. Think of other authors like Thomas Hardy, Dumas, Conan Doyle. Probably Sherlock Holmes is immediately in your mind thought of as serialized. The serialized novel was also a great way for people to learn to read. So in the 80s, 1880s and so on, as many people were coming to America from all around the world, this was how they learned English, how they learned to read, and how they learned about their community. Then, of course, the movies took this up, and perhaps you remember Sky King and various things of that nature where your parents dropped you off at the movie theater and got a free hour or two while you sat there for 25 cents and watched a serialized movie. And then, of course, television and radio picked it up. Various soap operas would be considered serialized novels, in a sense. So I feel very fortunate today to have with us some folks that are the brains behind this and the authors behind this very interesting series going on in the Ellsworth America. I have with me the managing editor of the Ellsworth American, Stephen Fay. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
And two authors that are part of this process, Monica Giordano.
Very well.
We've been practicing Giordano, and I think I've got it fairly close.
You did very well.
But welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also, Mac Herling, one of the other authors. Mac, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
All right. I'm going to turn to Stephen. As managing editor of the newspaper, at some point you had to make a decision whether to do this or not. Can you describe that process?
About a year ago, I received a letter from a reader, a gentleman who lives in Ellsworth by the name of Scott Shields, who professionally is a banker, but avocationally is a writer and interested in writing. And Scott knew the Ellsworth American, and he and I had a passing acquaintance. But he sent me a query letter. What would the Ellsworth American think about publishing a serialized novel in which each chapter was written by a different person? And he may have provided a little more background and argumentation about the idea, but that was the basic premise. And what I thought about it was that it seemed like the nuttiest idea I'd heard in a really long time. But I was intrigued. And I was also reminded that in the 1970s, there was a serialized novel in which each chapter was written by a different person. It was called Naked Came the Stranger. In fact, it was a spoof. I believe it was mounted by the newsroom at Newsday. And the idea was to write the world's worst novel and see if anybody noticed. The authorship was credited to a made-up person, a woman. And each chapter was more lurid than the one before it. Each was written by a different person. And it was quite a phenomenon. By the way, the book sold very well. And then I don't think, I'm not aware that anyone else ever tried that. Nor did Scott Shields reference that novel when he came up with his idea. I think it just came out of the blue. But I was intrigued, and it's always good to explore a new idea, see what happens. And so I put a notice in the Ellsworth American. It was November of 2013, almost a year ago, inviting interested writers or aspiring writers to come to the Ellsworth Public Library on a Wednesday evening, and let's talk about it. About 22 to 25 people turned out that first evening. And I had a very short script because I didn't know what to say. I put the idea before folks, and it was a very civilized free-for-all of first a discussion of genres, sci-fi, romance, historical novel, current. And so we knocked some ideas around, took down names, phone numbers, and said, let's have another meeting. The next meeting was at the Ellsworth American, either a week or 2 weeks later. And by natural Darwinian selection, about seven or eight people had dropped out. We had maybe 14 or 15 people at the second meeting. And we narrowed the focus a little bit more, decided we wanted it to be set in Ellsworth, and do some historical and not-so-historical landmark name-dropping so that in the course of the novel you hear about Rooster Brother, the Grand, the Mex, and, of course, the Black House. And eventually we got down to a story arc that changed a lot, and assigning chapters or people volunteering to do chapters. And we must have met weekly a couple of times for a while. We met twice a week and assessed one another's progress.
The group of people who showed up, two of which are here. Monica, you have contributed. There's been 11 chapters so far.
Yes. Right. Mm-hmm.
And you have to subscribe to the Ellsworth American to get these. So I hope most of you listening are subscribers and have been turning to the section in the middle, where Murder at the Black House is got a full pullout, so you can actually keep these chapters, as I've been doing. But Monica Giordano, I have to say this, I'm having such delight in saying
I'm
it.
So glad.
Okay. You wrote the most recent chapter, and in that chapter, there's a tag. Each time you write a chapter, you have kind of this tagline, as I understand it, mm-hmm. lead into the next chapter. And your the tagline on your last chapter was, if I have this correct, was, you wrote the eighth chapter.
I wrote chapter 8 and 13.
Was, come in, Denny, I've been waiting for you.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you're wondering what's going to happen next. What's it like writing a chapter and turning it over to someone else to write the next chapter?
It's so exciting, it's frustrating, it's frightening. I'm impatient with myself because suddenly I'm getting writer's block and I only have a day and a half to write this in because of my busy schedule. But it's thrilling to take the first seven chapters and see where it has progressed and realize that I have an opportunity to make the plot change. And in an unexpected way. So I chose to take a very, very small character of Livia and really make her the strength of the story. And once I decided that, it just flowed right out very easily. And I think that's when you tap into your writer's, what do you call it?
Creativity.
Creativity.
Yes.
Right. So it happened to work.
And I remember that issue, and it is a character that was very much in the background, mm-hmm. who all of a sudden became almost the lead, one of the leads anyway.
She's a very strong character.
With, a lot of background.
Yes.
And again, I apologize that because we're pre-recorded, we will not be able to take folks' phone calls today, because those of you that have been following, I'm sure you've noticed that interesting change. And that's what part of what makes it so exciting.
Yes.
You just never know, really, as a reader, where it's going to go next.
And the author that would come after me has to then decide, well, where did Monica want it to go? But then you have to take a step back and say, no, it's not where I want you to go. It's where you want to take it. And that's a change in thinking sometimes when you're writing something.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
To gain the initiative.
Mac, you wrote the second in the series, and your tagline was, "Stay out of my way."
Yes.
Was that sinister enough?
Yeah, I think I intended it to be that way. Again, like Monica talks about writing about Livia, I like the character of Dennison, and we had really kind of just stuck him in there as a side character, but he plays an important role, so it's important to get him introduced early on in the story. So that people have the sense that this guy could be up to no good.
And your style of writing, how's it felt for you to be part of a whole rather than the whole?
Well, I have been doing some writing on my own, short stories. I'm trying to work on a book, et cetera. I've written some poetry. So it's hard in a way to give up that control, because you're the committee of one,
right?
You're writing by yourself. But it's been very exciting because, as Monica said, everybody has their own style, their own point of view, their own experience, and you just never know what's going to come out. But somehow, like any committee, especially, I don't know how to get eight people to do much together, but we managed to work together quite well, and it really has each author's imprimatur.
So, Stephen, this is a situation where you've brought a group of authors together and they sit down at a table and discuss where things are going, generally speaking, how it's going to end, places that you want to be. How does that work as opposed to, say, six or seven authors who are totally separate and don't talk to each other?
Well, to have six or seven or eight authors in the same room reading and critiquing one another's work, I think was a pretty terrible idea.
Certainly dangerous.
It is dangerous. Writers, myself included, are prickly, and their words and chapters and paragraphs are their babies, and they want them handled with care. Doesn't always happen. So I think there's a lot to be said for writing in your different silos. That said, we did form a critical mass that was, if anything, the plot committee. And we were, with all the disparate contributions the different writers were making to the effort, there was an understanding there was a general effort. We were going to end up somewhere. We finally held hands and decided, yes, by the end of the book, Claire was going to graduate from high school. The evil person would be identified and put in irons. The innocent person would be vindicated. And there were a couple of other goals, targets, places that we had to come in for a landing. And then the different authors, and they are very different, both in background, writing style, and age. I think we went from like 18 or 19 to 75, and it all came across in their different contributions, with the result that it's a really extraordinary critter that we have created.
Has there been surprises for you?
Well, the surprise for me is that it's enjoyed tremendous popularity and buy-in. And speaking of buy, people are buying subscriptions to the Ellsworth American to find out what's going to happen next. So it's been a good reader and circulation promotion. I get calls about once a week from people asking if we're going to issue a bound version of this, a book.
And are you?
I don't know. We might. It's a business decision. Yeah. If we think that we can, we have the capacity to do it at the Ellsworth American, obviously. It's a matter of if we think that that would be a prudent business decision, as well as a, you know, popular among those who have gotten in touch. Could happen.
This could be the Nancy Drew of Ellsworth.
It could very well be, yes. And but that interest has just continues. I think it has a lot to do with the originality of the idea and the execution and the name dropping that we do throughout the novel. It makes it very, it makes it the community's own novel.
Yeah, Mac, you were noting, I think, earlier that the name dropping, the bringing up the various places, the Grand and so on around, has made a difference, do you think, in terms of readership?
Oh, sure. I mean, you can hear that even in the first meeting we had with the Giant Committee, where people really wanted to take it to the high school and bring in different businesses and use names that are common in the Ellsworth area, such as Beale, you know, the lead character, Claire. So definitely it's had a hometown feel to it.
And Monica, is this something that you have found is difficult to incorporate or easy to incorporate?
Oh, no. I had such a good time because a lot of us were concerned about slander if we had used somebody's name in connection with something. And Stephen volunteered that he would be the slander moderator. And I don't think we came close to anything, did we, Steve?
No.
No. But I enjoyed including Lynn Dunbar from Sullivan Town Office and the history of my own home, which is historic in Sullivan Harbor, and some of the history of Sullivan I brought in to my chapter as well. And I so enjoyed bumping Lynn Dunbar off, even though I was told I had to ask her permission before I did it, which she gladly gave.
And if she hadn't?
I would have had to change my writing.
How's it feel to be a gatekeeper on slander?
Well, that's my job.
Yeah, well, that's true. As editor, that's your job.
By the way, slander is when you say it, and
libel
is when you write it.
Okay.
And
right.
So
right.
My daily job is to make sure we do not commit libel.
Libel. So you're adding slander to it now.
Well, anyway.
I misspoke.
Hurting somebody's feelings is not libel.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a comment about Stephen, too. He's been a wonderful editor and
yes.
The mediator. It's interesting, in the very beginning when we had our group of eight or nine, whatever it was, he was sitting on chairs, sort of leaning against the wall, and then as the discussion got more heated and more intense, he came closer and closer until finally he was sitting at the table and then deciding that we needed a moderator
yeah,
to help us sort it out.
Referee,
yes, that's the word.
So... Well, let me ask my next question, get back to this. You're indicating that this is a group of creators who
yes.
came together around a table mm-hmm. and had to agree eventually on where things were going and then had to fit their style into that storytelling mode. Has that been a difficult process for you as creators?
I think we've all had our challenges with that. I think when I was writing, I like to use foreshadowing, and I like to go back in time, and there was some
objection.
What
does foreshadowing mean?
Golly, help me out, Steve.
Foreshadowing means that if in chapter one there's some reference to a shotgun, then somewhere by chapter five or chapter six, that shotgun should be a part of the plot.
Yeah, I got you. Mm-hmm.
And writing back in time as well, there was some concern that that shouldn't be done. But I'm an avid reader myself, and I always enjoy that aspect when I read a novel. So I was eager to try my hand at that myself. So it's been a wonderful experience working with a great deal of diversified creative people. And we really shouldn't forget Mary Walsh. Out of Sullivan. She's a friend mm-hmm. of mine. She's the former librarian in Sullivan. She's a wonderful artist, and she did all the artwork for the novel.
Yes, there's been sketches with each
yes.
chapter.
Yes, yeah. Beautiful work. beautiful work.
Yeah, that's helped a lot.
Yes.
Yes. We were discussing earlier about storytelling on the radio and how people listen and put images in their minds of the characters and so on. So sketching, I guess, can both contribute. And when I first saw the female lead sketch, she was a little different than what I had in my mind. But I like the sketch. It works for me. It gives me some solidity around the character.
We were all invited to bring in photographs or pick out from the internet an image that we thought our character looked like to us. And I believe those images were then given to Mary. And she's the only one that read the novel from beginning to end.
She read the novel all the way through as well. And so she knew, had an idea about what folks look like.
She was right on target.
Uh-huh.
No one was disappointed.
Nope.
No, it was very good.
Yeah.
Speaking of disappointments, have there been any disappointments for either of you as writers and Stephen as the gatekeeper? Have there been any, it just didn't work the way I wanted it to work?
I think Stephen mentioned, you know, that writers cherish their words and their paragraphs like babies. And when it comes to 7, 8, 9 people doing that, there definitely has to be a lot of editing. And in the beginning, we weren't sure what the plot was going to be. I had talked about having ghosts at the Black House and supernatural kind of things, but people really weren't enamored of that. So that went out the window.
Did that temper your enthusiasm for the process at all?
No, because it was really a group decision. We had to agree on it. If we weren't going to agree, then it would have been even worse. But we have little hints of that in the story, so I'm pretty happy with it.
It was a group dynamics Olympics.
Yeah.
The compromise and negotiation that went on for the better part of 9 months was a real textbook case.
Because all of you are write in a little garret somewhere, be it your home or be at the bus stop, and to actually have to sit and listen to another author say, I want it to go this way or it shouldn't go that way. Stephen, as the idea matured initially for you, you must have started to have images of what was going to happen and how it was going to happen. Pictures in mind of the Bleak House or the storyline. Has that changed over time? Has it matured? Has it disappointed you at all?
Well, there's certainly no disappointment. My job really was to make sure that it came out, that people finished and that it could be edited and printed. And so my job really was as publisher. I wasn't even the editor. That job went to Scott Shields, whose idea this was in the first place. And he worked with one of the other writers to go over the final manuscript. I didn't want to put my oar in too deep because I'm not the author. And I, in no respect is my writing or writing style reflected in the book. It's the work of the other folks here. But my job, it's really like a warehouse foreman. I just wanted to make sure we got the product in on time and that we could then manufacture these weekly chapters.
Let me push back a little. I can't understand how you as an author would not be saying to yourself, why did he write that sentence? That just doesn't make any sense.
Well, again, that's another thing I say every day as I'm doing my regular job. Also, I have plenty of opportunity to write and publish myself. I've got a movie review and a wine column every week, so I'm happy.
All right, good. Where did the title Murder at the Black House come from?
I think just stating the obvious, which was to give a hint of what was coming. And we wanted to include a local place right in it so that people would be drawn right in.
And we had a lovely interview with the director of the Black House. We were all invited to go there at night in the dark. And he did a wonderful slideshow and history of the Black House, of the owners and occupants of the home, which gave us wonderful ideas of where the story could go, from Turkey to possible homosexual relationship going on.
It's a very exotic history there of the Black House. And Josh Torrance, executive director, was very gracious, invited the whole group up one evening, And everybody was quite enthusiastic. He gave a comprehensive history, a lot of the secrets and background and of the Black House. And people really worked up after that. And a number of the historical elements that he introduced us to found their way into the story.
Mm-hmm. This kind of background work, is this typical of any author working in a serial or alone to dig in this deep?
I can't imagine not doing it myself. Matt,
likewise.
What do you think?
No, I totally agree. You have to have some accuracy there. You can't make up locations and historical references without having it that people, something that people could recognize. So,
I think I'm very aware of the long-term residence of down east coastal Maine. I had a little church in Sullivan, and my organist was 94 years old, and she used to winter in the house that I live in now. And she would tell me stories about life on the coast. And so I wanted to make sure that when I told about the ship where Livia's fiancé died, that that was a real ship in the real harbor, because that's right across the street from my house. People in that part of Sullivan know that cove. So I think it's very important to have verisimilitude brought into the process.
Well, with this degree, Stephen, of connection to the reader's community, do you get feedback from your readers as to about the references and about the story as a whole?
Story as a whole, definitely. And I think that a lot of the engagement is brought about by the familiar references. So I'd say the answer is yes.
Well, the references are, I think, a bit unique to storytelling. I don't know whether a Stephen King or so who lives in this community would use that much reference, at least so blatantly made. The grand is right there as the grand, not disguised in any way, shape, or form. So perhaps that's part of the feedback that you're getting, that these are so real places to people.
Yes.
Well, if you talk to Stephen King, when they did the movie of The Shining, he really didn't like the movie adaptation, but he was very pleased with the setting, which is, in, I think, someplace in Colorado, anyway, for an example. But some of the challenges, I think, for people were keeping the fiction element in it so that we could go freely in one direction with the character. And then the difficulty, I think, was keeping the voice of the character consistent throughout the chapters, at least to some degree, and looking back on previous chapters and making it make sense. And that was a big help from Stephen, that he would keep track of that stuff for us and we could write away.
Could you elaborate on what you mean by the voice?
Well, in other words, Clara's voice. She's the lead character.
Right.
And everybody has a different, all the authors had different takes on what she would say. So to keep some of the dialogue consistent and to keep her relationship, for example, with Jen, her best friend, and what role Jen was going to play and how things would be discovered in each chapter and what Claire's reaction would be. And, of course, the big deal is her relationship with Anders. And Elizabeth did a great job in her chapter being the youngster of the group of firing up that romance so that people could get some sparks going there.
The as we were, again, talking about some authors like dialogue and some favor exposition. Mm-hmm. In trying to keep both alive in each chapter, how has that been for you as authors? Because I would imagine each of you has a tendency towards a style or a voice, as you say, of your own.
Yeah. No, I think everybody has their strength. And I think, for example, with Monica, she has a beautiful writing style and it lends a lot of description and building up attention and information that way, where she really puts it out there and describes the setting as well as provides a dialogue. I tend to go more with a dialogue, and other authors have their own unique style that kind of blends both.
Monica, you were talking about the last chapter that you worked on and how you made some real in-depth additions to a specific character. How did where did that come from, and why did you want to go in that direction with her?
In retrospect, after the writing was done and submitted, I realized I was probably writing about myself. Huh. And that I wanted to be a strong character, and I want women to be strong. And so I think I put a lot of myself into Livia. And I don't know, Mac, did you put yourself into
it? Oh, yeah, I think that's an easy tendency. And I think given, you know, in generalities, I mean, a lot of us are older, and we have the younger writers, but certainly you want a character to kind of reflect the dialogue and the kind of approach to life that you have. There's no question about that.
Let me just take, we're at about the halfway point here, just to recognize that this is WERU Community Radio, and we are 89.9 in Blue Hill and 99.9 in Bangor. And we are here today talking to a very interesting group of gatekeepers and authors and writers and editors from a serialized novel that's being produced by and included in the Ellsworth American, Murder at the Black House. I have with us Stephen Fay, who's the editor of Ellsworth American, who kind of kicked this idea off, as well as Monica Giordano, one of the authors, and Mac Herling, one of the authors. So again, this is part of Maine Arts Alive, our salute, WERU salute to the arts and artists of Maine. Mac, we were talking about bringing yourself into the story writing. Is this more difficult when you're just doing a chapter, or do you find yourself becoming somewhat schizophrenic?
Oh, I think I'm already schizophrenic to begin with. But anyway, it's interesting because Monica alluded to the fact that we have to pick up where the previous author left off. And in my case, you know, it was the first chapter. So it was a setting at the Black House and a couple of places. So I chose the setting to be the police station where the official investigation was going on. And then you've got the choice to who you're going to bring in, what are they going to say. I think it was fine. I don't think it was that difficult because we had our little world of each chapter, and then you left it to the next person to pick up that thread and pick up the cliffhanger and go with there. So it was okay. Uh-huh. I think if it had been a much longer chapter, say like 3,000 or 4,000 words, that would have been much tougher.
So right now each chapter is about, you said, 1,000 to 15?
1,500 to 2,000 words.
15 to 2. Okay.
And we didn't try to smooth everything out and make one author's fingerprints from each chapter so that it appeared to be a single effort. The different chapters have different voices and different meters, for sure. They've got the same characters, and the characters continue to have the same motivations. But the way they express themselves and the way they, the relationships they have with one another are quite nuanced from chapter to chapter.
Oh, absolutely. But in talking with Monica here, this one character, it seemed to me all of a sudden blossomed in a way that I hadn't anticipated. So you've really taken one character and placed her stage front.
It took a lot of people by surprise.
And Mac, what was your reaction to that out of curiosity?
I think it's important. We had, was it 5 women authors? Anyway, a lot of women involved. And it wasn't surprising that we needed a strong woman. And that Claire was a strong woman to begin with. But to have a older woman as kind of a mentor and her, you know, ally in the whole story, I think was a great idea. I think people were a little surprised the way Livia went, but at the same time, it was Monica's choice.
And where are you going to take this?
You'll find out.
Fair enough.
I have the last chapter to write. I mean, it's already written, but that was a challenge by itself. But I think going back to what Stephen said, we had tug of wars over months, you know, starting in the fall, then through the winter, and then in the spring. And Stephen said, we have to get this done by X date. And, you know, there was a lot of give and take, and people delayed sometimes, and people took longer to do a chapter, and then we had different ways of critiquing it. But so it was, you know, it was kind of a barroom brawl at times, and then other times it was very smooth.
We all ended up friends.
Yes.
Well, that's good.
And I might add, you can meet all the friends on Friday, November 7th. I think it's at from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Black House. We are going to be hosting a reception for the authors and the illustrator. And it's free, but we need people to RSVP. And there's a form in the novel itself, in the Ellsworth American, that folks can fill out and ask for tickets. The limit is 45, and we're moving towards that that number now as we speak. So folks who would like to see the Black House and see the Murder at the Black House crew, we're going to be there on Friday, November 7th at 5 p.m.
Will you do this again, Stephen?
Yes.
Already, yes. Why?
Well, I think that it's been very gratifying, the reception that this has received. It's a good idea for newspapers to mix it up and not stick with the staid old formula of delivering news and information. And I've got a couple of ideas for how we might do something. It'll still be kind of loopy, but a little less bloodshed the next time around.
You ready to share any of those?
Well, I think that the public readings of each chapter, I'm really reconsidering that. I think I'd rather have a summary of each chapter, because sitting around and everybody's an expert, nine people at the table, one person reading, and I'm all for the individual talented people there to write in their style, to be correcting the other authors that and which, well, that should be a clause in opposition. Oh, she would never say that. took a lot of time and a lot of restraint. Not always successful. Yes. So I think we'll do a little more of the creating individually at home, and then sharing where we're going, and even asking some questions, asking for help on how am I going to get out of this jam? What do you think if we have this character go in this direction, that character go in that direction? So we'll deal more with the plot and less with the artistic execution of each chapter.
Mac, you are jumping up and down during that. Vehemently applauding.
I think, as I said before, Stephen was a great person to have on board, even though he claims he didn't write any, which he didn't really, but he was the level head many times. And I think I'm guessing that Stephen had his doubts about doing it again maybe at some point during last winter, and we were hot and heavy at it. But anyway, we, you know, I think it's a great idea, and it's important to have new blood and new ideas and have somebody else participate in it in a different way.
You said initially, Stephen, that this was kind of a nutsy, I can't remember your exact phrase.
Close enough.
Nutsy idea. I would imagine the success has stimulated other nutsy ideas in terms of, you know, would you ever do this with community input? Or would you ever do it serializing it on a stage as it's written? What are the possibilities?
So there's a lot. We had talked, and in fact, one of the features of the reception on November 7th will be a live reading of the last chapter. It'll be the people
by
there
the
will
author?
Be the by the author.
By the author.
The people present on that occasion will know how the novel ends before that last chapter is printed, because the last chapter is going to be in the Ellsworth American, whatever the Thursday after November 7th is, and so it's a sneak preview of the end of the show. I am interested in doing another serialized community-written novel with different authors for different chapters. I don't have any other original ideas at the moment. I just want to do this one more time. Then we might try something else. And I think you're right about different ways of delivering the message with readings or a play or who knows what.
Yeah. Yes. I mentioned at the beginning there's a gentleman out in Denver that's he calls himself Denver Cereal. Actually, the cereal that you eat for breakfast. And this gentleman has just completed his 333rd edition to this ongoing novel. I don't know how many volumes, but could this ever come to life in that fashion, just an ongoing product?
Yeah, I think that it could, and I say that simply because I didn't believe this original effort was going to ring a lot of bells, and I've been delighted with the reception and the reaction. So who knows? Maybe we are meeting a unmet need, a hunger that nobody knew was out there.
Well, certainly the storytelling element. We're just talking at ERU about the fact that storytelling is something that a lot of our listeners have been interested in. And you are kind of taking on a new role for Ellsworth American, as you say, not to just be a news item or a news conveyor, but also a storyteller. And that's very engrossing. But what is, Monica, what is immediately comes to your mind when I say someone who has just finished his 333rd episode?
How exhausting.
Yes.
I thought maybe WERU would like to have the author read their chapter for those who aren't able to read themselves, perhaps, nursing home people, the elderly, who would like to get involved.
I tell you what, I'd be willing to read some chapters from time to
time.
Really? If the gatekeeper over there would let us do it.
Wow.
That'd be fine.
But I think that, yeah, there's a real need for this kind mm-hmm. of work, and you don't see it that often. Mac, what comes to your mind when if you sat down across from this gentleman, what would you say to him, 333 segments?
He must drink a lot of coffee. But I think that there's so many avenues. For example, Margaret Atwood has written a book, and I can't think of the title right now, the Canadian author. But she solicited, I think she published a chapter online, and then people would throw in comments, and then she would adapt the characters based on that. So there certainly is other ways of doing this.
Yeah.
I could even think of improvisation. You know, maybe people would read a part of a chapter and then kind of, you know, make it up as they went along live on air or on a stage, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of spin-offs of it.
Yeah. The process of reading this, to what degree do you keep the reader in mind? There's obvious each chapter picks up from the last, has a build in the story, and then has to end leaving it ready for the next author. This is a unique process. Is it one that you found difficulty with or at ease with?
I found it easy to do. But there again, what the difference I came across with is writing for the reader versus writing for the oral presentation. Because as a minister, I certainly do a lot of oral presentation writing. So writing for the reader had a different feel to it. But I think it comes down to the ability of being able to tell a good story.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping the reader in mind is paramount, I think.
Now, your background as a minister and writing sermons and so on and so forth, how did that play other than consciousness around the reader? How did that play for you in terms of writing dialogue and so on and so forth?
I don't do a whole lot of dialogue. It's
I'll be an interesting sermon.
It would be. But I don't have the experience and the skill that Mac has. He's better at dialogue than I am. I have a tendency to avoid it, and I probably should learn to deal with it.
Interesting. So it's been a learning process
yes.
for you as well?
And I think my challenge next time is to say more with fewer words. Was it Hemingway who came up with mm-hmm. baby shoes for sale, never worn? That tells a whole story in those few short
words. Like a six-word memoir.
Yeah, right. I would love to write with such clarity and depth. So that's a personal goal for me.
There's a great quote, I can never remember who said it, but in sending a letter to a friend said, if I had had more time, this letter would have been shorter. And anybody know who said that?
I don't.
I love that quote.
Maybe Mark Twain?
Yeah, it could well be. Sounds like something he'd say.
Yeah.
The idea of writing dialogue versus exposition, is Monica correct that dialogue's more to your favor, and how did that work?
Well, it's interesting how our occupations influence how we write and how we think, because, you know, as a minister, she has to come across that way and storytelling and so forth. But as a former social worker, I hear so many great lines and characters come to me, and I've worked in psychiatric hospitals, so I've got plenty of dialogue that I like to put in my own work. And it's easier for me just because having to listen to so much of it and pick up on it. Yeah, but you tune in your ear and you hear that.
You have plenty of stories.
Absolutely. Some good stuff. I just have to change the names.
Pass that through, Steve. The idea, as you just said, that each of you bring your other lives. I wouldn't say necessarily professional lives, because both of you consider yourselves as writers.
Mm-hmm.
How has this been for you in terms of incorporating your own life, but as a learning process, as a process of growth for you as writers? How has this been effective or not?
Well, I think it's taught me a lot about being more patient, being able to listen better, ironically, having been a social worker, but it was always with kids and families, but to also to respect people's different voices and how wonderful they can be, and to let them write and give them a lot of support, and we all learn from each other, and it all comes together at the end.
So these voices, did they materialize in your writing of this story?
Yes, I think each author, you know, we had fits and starts, we have rough beginnings, we had rough endings, but we all help each other to make sense of it. And as Monica said before, really respect the reader and what they were going to have to understand and experience with each chapter.
Yeah. From a reader standpoint, which I am simply going to take it rather than narrator here or host here as a reader, I found that the first chapter definitely set the tone for this. Was that first chapter, Stephen, a surprise to you?
I was very pleased with it.
Yeah.
And I agree. It laid out the... It did a lot of foreshadowing and sketched in the characters and gave us a number of good places to go with the storyline.
What would it take for you to say, I don't want that printed?
Well, it would be a real bad idea for me to say that. I would negotiate and compromise with one of the authors if there was some facet that I thought was either going to be offensive or be a plot killer, never came up.
Yeah.
So I'm happy. Yeah. I wanted to add something.
Please.
Monica had mentioned the verisimilitude that we and Mac agreed that bringing in actual life experience, genuine knowledge, always enhances writing. Than just making things up that you don't know anything about. Our illustrator, very similar, Mary Welsh, as she read the novel through and then had assigned herself the job of illustrating the characters and some of the scenes. Well, she went to the Black House. She studied it. She studied the roads and the stone fences. She went to the Ellsworth Police Department and said, I need to see in an interrogation room what that's going to look like. I need to see what you wear, what's on your gun belt. And they're very accommodating, and she sketched that. And so it brought a lot of actual, well, you know, laboriously won detail to the illustrations. It really helped.
It helps me as a reader, certainly. Again, as I say, and to a certain degree, I had a picture in my mind, and then the illustration altered it slightly, but it still very much works. Did the idea of illustrations, was this born right along with the whole idea, or did this come along?
No, it was total serendipity. Uh-huh. Mary Welsh came into the Ellsworth American to discuss the possibility of editorial cartooning.
Ah.
And she had done it for other publications, showed me her work. And while she was showing me her work, I thought, boy, wouldn't this be great to have a local illustrator working with our local authors on this locally set story. And she agreed and was enthusiastic. Very fast turnaround time on these really fine drawings.
How have these illustrations affected you as authors? Have they led your thinking, or do they just mirror your thinking?
Well, we didn't really see them, did we, until
you the pretty much was, had to wait till the whole
really?
Chapters
yeah,
came.
Yeah,
oh,
okay. Yeah.
Well, I take my question back.
Yeah, it came late in the process.
Okay.
But Mary came in and said, sure, I'll illustrate. And it was like, great, because up to then we were using different takes on photographs
and
Photoshopped pictures of the Black House.
I got you.
So it really gave some dimension.
Would you two like to have seen illustrations along the way?
No, I like the idea of just imagining what a person looks like. But then when people brought in, as Monica said, brought in Photoshop stuff or photographs of people they imagine they look like, that was great.
I think at one of our later meetings I brought in the portraits that Mary had done of the different characters.
That's right.
And folks got a chance to see them. And it was like it just made the whole thing seem all that more real.
Did it change your attitude at all?
Well, I've known Mary for almost 20 years, mm-hmm. and I'm always impressed with her work. And she's done work for me at my own home. And I had no doubt or question that she would rise to the occasion. She's so intuitive that she can bring anything to life. So
she did a great job with the illustrations.
Wonderful.
I'd like to ask each of you in turn to just tell me how this experience has changed you, if at all, as authors, as gatekeepers, editors. How has this changed you, Monica, if at all?
It has changed me because, believe it or not, I'm a very shy person, particularly with my words, because I think words carry so much weight. And I think I've gained courage and the confidence that maybe I have something to offer that I've been hiding under a bushel.
So you will do more of this?
Yes, sir, I certainly will.
And you kind of hope Stephen will ask you back again?
Oh, I certainly hope so, Stephen.
Stephen, how has this altered your work?
Well, it's shown me that it's probably better to say yes than to say no to a new idea.
And has this... As a managing editor, you're working with reporters day in and day out.
Right.
You're working with a different kind of writer or a different approach to writing. Has this work changed your appreciation or viewpoint or tack on that?
No, I'm still very bossy in the newsroom and insist on getting my own way.
That's the definition of an editor, isn't it?
But the working with the writers, then I was much more involved in the production, indeed the physical production of the piece and making sure we made deadline so that I had enough time to put the different elements and the artwork together and have it come out when we wanted it to come out. So it was a different experience working with people, and I enjoy both roles very much.
Okay. Mac?
Well, it's taught me a couple of things. I was thinking when Monica and Stephen were speaking that having other writers to critique your stuff, it makes you more tuned in to what the reader thinks as you're writing it and to keep the voice consistent over chapters. And also to from different people creating and adding to different characters, it's helped me to flesh out the kind of characters that I do in my own writing to make them three-dimensional and credible.
We've been talking to the contributing authors and manager of this the herding cats process of creating Murder at the Black House, which has been serialized in the Ellsworth American. We have here with us, we've been speaking with Stephen Fay, who's the managing, or the, just, is it managing editor?
Yes.
Okay. How can people get a hold of this if they're not subscribers?
Giving the paper call, 667-2576. And if you want to catch up on what you've missed, we can help you with that as well.
Great. Well, Stephen, thank you for being here today. And we've had Monica Giordano with us. Monica, thank you for being with us, and thank you for contributing so beautifully to this process.
Thank you for the honor.
And Mac Hurling, who is an additional member of the writing group, thank you for being here today.
Oh, it's been great. Thank you so much.
And for those of you tuning in to this show on a regular basis, if you want to contribute with some notes or thoughts about a show, you can go to the WERU webpage and connect to MaineArtsAlive.com, and I try and keep some information about shows there. Or you can just go on the web, MaineArtsAlive.com, but I'd really like you to go to WERU's website and check in through there. There's a lot going on that site. Again, thank you all. Have a good day, and good day.